Cool. Let's get into the text. Oh, we have plenty of time. Awesome. Matthew chapter 11, verse 25. Chapter 11, we just got off of a major section in which Jesus is contrasting the kingdom that was expected versus the kingdom that he has brought. And that's the primary issue. John the Baptist kicks off the whole chapter by asking a question of doubt, which makes me comfortable. You know, especially in the last 24 hours, I have been wrestling with where does doubt fit into the Christian life. And it's a part of being human. If John the Baptist, the one that cried out that Jesus was coming, says, I have doubt, then I feel like I'm sitting in pretty good company. You know what I'm saying? Is it John with the guy that Jesus heals his son, I think it is, and the guy says, I believe, but help me with my unbelief. And I like that. That gives me comfort that I'm not abnormal. But that John and I, we could hang out. John asks a pretty intriguing question. What's John's difficulty with Jesus, with his identity? Yeah, John hears what Jesus was doing, and he sends his disciples to ask the question, are you the one to come, or should we be expecting someone else? Because what Jesus was doing was not matching up with what John thought he should be doing. And what did John think he should be doing? As the Messiah, what did John think Jesus should be doing? Think of of Matthew chapter 3. Overthrow the Roman government. Yeah, he was thinking, why aren't you kicking the tails of all of our enemies? Where's this at? What else should he be doing, the Messiah? Anybody? What's that? Yeah. If I am Elijah, why am I sitting in prison for the last year and a half? Why am I not out here experiencing all the blessings of this kingdom? What are you doing? What else should the Messiah be doing?
Exalting Israel.
Exalting Israel. And what is the mission? What is the thing that Jesus is doing? He's yelling at Israel saying, you're a mess, repent. That's not the message he should be saying to Israel. That's the message he should be saying to the Gentiles. See, there's a lot of what John is seeing Jesus doing, going out and healing and all these things, that John's going, this isn't the kingdom I thought I was signing up for. And Jesus says, man, go tell him. Go tell him what you heard and what you saw. That you saw the lame walk, and that you saw the blind see, and that you saw the deaf hear. And that I'm preaching the good news to who? To the poor. Those are Old Testament passages that will probably appear on the test. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, dear friends. He then goes on and describes what this generation is like. He says, this generation's like children who are sitting in a marketplace playing flutes, saying, dance! They're like children sitting in the marketplace that are playing a funeral dirge, saying, mourn. And they're not satisfied with either one. Forcing the kingdom to be what we want it to be, or rejecting it wholesale because it's not what we were expecting, or not because what we want. Because we want the kingdom to be what we want it to be. Why? Because we are selfish little children. And the irony of this is that in a minute Jesus will say, but there is a part of you that needs to be like a child to understand this kingdom. There are elements of children that are very positive that we need to model. There are elements of children that frankly just make us selfish and make us miss the kingdom as a whole, like a cobweb or something up here. Ultimately, he's contrasting the kingdoms. That's the point. We go to verses 20 through 24, where he's, in a sense, calling down judgment on the three cities, Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. Why was he calling down judgment on them? That it doesn't matter what he did in front of them, they still rejected. That there is a very big truth when it comes to ears to hear and eyes to see. I think there's a very big point in that. That I'll be honest with you, that the reality is this. It doesn't matter to some cities if God would come down, look him in the face, and tell them exactly what they wanted to know, they still would find a way not to believe. Still. It's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. And Jesus says, my word, if Tyre and Sidon and Sodom would have seen what you've seen, they'd still remain to this day. But look at what you've seen, and yet you still look at me and say, you're a joke. Jesus says, man, on the day of judgment, it's going to be rough. You know, this is something in my personal walk that I wrestle with. That I'm never content with the way in which God moves in my life. Josh and I had a conversation yesterday, and there's a lot of it that I'm reflecting on, even just in my own life, that God never does it the right way, according to me. I always want it different. Always. You know, if he's not doing miracles, I want him to do miracles. If he's doing miracles, I'm saying, yeah, but you know, you're just trying to manipulate. I mean, I always have a way in which God's not doing it right. Always. And I'm talking, this is totally autobiographical. And it's frustrating. But I look at the people of Israel and they were the same way. Like this isn't a shame problem. This is a human problem. This is the way we work. We always think that we have a better perspective of the way in which God needs to run this place. Always. And there's part of that that's enviable. There's part of that that's beautiful, because God doesn't smite us whenever we do think things that are that audacious. And there's a part of it that just gets in the way. There's a lot of me that always says, I wish I were back in Egypt. You know what I mean by that? Where my word, God parts the Red Sea. After the 10 plagues, pulls them through into this in this wilderness. And what do they start whining about? Yeah, man, what'd you do? Bring us out to the desert to die? He just liberated you from one of the most voracious kingdoms that had existed to that point in history. Miraculously. And now you're saying he can't provide for you? What if you guys went 2 years without eating? Do you think he can't do that? Do you think he can't sustain you in whatever way he desires? What is it that they're wrestling with? The system in which God is functioning. I want the system different. This isn't acceptable to me. It makes me wonder, like, how God reacts to some of those things that we put on him. You know? Like, this world should be much more peaceful if God was truly powerful and good. Really? How can we say something like that? Or in moments of like whenever you're going through like a miscarriage. I've been there. My wife and I, we had a miscarriage. My daughter is 4. Been about 5 years ago. And in that moment, it is very easy for me to be like, you know what, God, if you're all powerful and you're almighty and you're all good, how could you let something like this happen? I did do that. And I did have people say some stupid stuff to me. I had a guy that told me, and I considered him one of my second dad. We're down in my basement and we're working on finishing the basement. And you know, and I'm still kind of grieving through this, trying to figure out what to do with this. And he goes, you know what this means, don't you? And I said, what? He said, it means that God's got something even better for you in store. And I remember sitting there with a hammer in my hand, and I was like, no, don't throw it at him. Because I almost said it, because I think, and I'm glad I did, honestly, if I would have thrown it at him, it would have hurt a lot less than if I would have said what I wanted to say. Because I wanted to look at him and say, I'm sorry, what's better than my child living? Can you Can you help me with that one? Please, just rate what you think God can give me that is better than my child living. I'd like to hear your answer to that, please. There's no answer to that. That's a stupid way of looking at God. But because bad things happen to you, that means if it gets really bad, then God's going to give you something really good. You know what? Tell that to Job. Or the Jobs that live today. Whenever it gets worse, oh, it's because God's got good things. What if there isn't good things in store for you? Will you still follow God? Christianity based on emotions, either way, is not positive. Christianity based on logic, either way, is not positive. Why? Because God functions off different systems. And, like Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum, we can choose to accept that or reject that. That's our choice. Bottom line is this, and this is application for me and for everyone. Are you willing to hear God speak on His terms, or does He have to meet your terms before you choose to listen? Man, it's the same thing I critique our churches about sometimes whenever it comes to sinners. You have to get everything right before you can walk in here. Does God have to get everything right before you say, now I'll listen? Just musings, if you will. At that time, Jesus said, verse 25, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned. Oh, this is funny how Jesus talks with me. And revealed them to little children. See the irony of this? Verse 17, he said, this generation, this 16 and 17, this generation is like little children. And then he says, man, you've revealed this to children, though. You know what? Him calling Jesus calling God Father and Lord of heaven and earth, who would that have not made happy? Religious leaders? Probably. Because who is Jesus to talk to our God that way? Who else would it have made it mad? Made them mad. What? Romans. And you want to know why? Because the emperor was referred to as the parent of the world. He was referred to as father quite consistently. He was referred to as the ruler of the earth. They would not be so audacious until much later. In the mythology of Rome, mythology not in the sense of fake, but in the sense of the story that makes sense to them. But the mythology of Rome wouldn't develop till later. Before, they would not call the emperor in the time of Jesus Lord of heaven and earth. They would call him Lord of earth, but not heaven and earth. Why? Who is Lord of heaven, according to them? What? Zeus. The gods. Zeus being the primary god of the Jewish understanding of that, Jupiter being the Roman understanding of that, same entity. That's who is the Lord of heaven. But the Lord of earth is the one in which these gods have put in place on earth, which would be the emperor. The emperor would not become divinized until after he was dead most of the time, although by the time this was written, they would have been on there. Probably second, possibly third emperor that was claiming to be God in the flesh while he existed. Let's see, you can get that from Marshall Epigram 7.7.5, 9.6.1, in case you think I'm lying about the whole parent of the world thing. That's the reference. You can look it back up on this one later if you want. Ruler of the earth, yeah, Statius also talks about that. Let me read this, though, to you. This I just find interesting, because Lord of heaven and earth is not just a moniker. It also points to an occupation. Seneca, in Clement 1.2-3, has Nero saying this. This is Nero. He had Nero. Seneca was the tutor of Nero in Nero's early days, before Nero made Seneca commit suicide, because Nero's syphilis probably went to his head. But before that happened, Nero wrote this about how he saw himself functioning in the world. Nero says, "Have I of all mortals found favor with heaven? And been chosen to serve on earth as vicar of the gods. I am the arbiter of life and death for the nations." Did you just hear that? It rests in my power what each man's lot and state shall be. By my lips fortune proclaims what gifts she would bestow on each human being. From my utterance peoples and cities gather reasons for rejoicing. Without my favor and grace, no part of the whole world can prosper. All those many thousands of swords which my peace restrains will be drawn at my nod. What nation shall be utterly destroyed, which banished, which shall receive the gift of liberty, which have it taken from them? What kings shall become slave, and whose head shall be crowned with royal honor? What city shall rise and which shall fall? This is mine to decree. What is he saying? He is the Lord of the earth. And what he says goes. Even life and death, it's up to Nero to say where that flies. Even the prosperity of the nations, it is his gift to decide where it goes. Fortune is a goddess. And he even tells Fortune where to go. He is the orchestrator of the earth and the way in which the gods interact with it. That is all of his to decree. And that's something that Jesus' statement would not have agreed with. Reveal to little children. This is why that is audacious. Jesus saying this was revealed to little children is making his kingdom look foolish. Because in the ancient world, children were looked at a lot in the same lens of the way in which women were looked at. Sorry. Women and children both were looked at as parasites on society. The only thing they did was suck out of society. The only thing they did was drain the society of its honor and resources. They were not contributors. Children especially, the worst category you could possibly exist in at one time in the ancient world was a female child. You had absolutely nothing to give to the society. Nothing. As a matter of fact, it was encouraged in the ancient world at one point even by the emperor himself, Augustus, through a decree that abortion should be an option that they look into, especially when they know it's a female daughter. Abortion a lot of times was very dangerous for them. They would be along the lines of drinking poison, small doses, so that it would kill the baby, but hopefully not you. Or, if you really want to just bawl sometimes, read Rodney Stark's book, The Rise of Christianity, where he talks about the ways in which abortions happened, because a lot of them had to deal with hooks and just pulling out whatever they could. But what happens if the baby is born? What do you do then? What if the baby's born and it's deformed? What if the baby's born and you decide you don't want it? There was another very common practice, especially in the cities, called exposure, where what you would do is literally take the child and just go set it out into the sewers that were passing by, whatever it was. As a matter of fact, we found in one of the ancient cities in the region of Asia Minor, that the bathhouse was actually clogged. Their sewer system was clogged because there were so many baby carcasses in there. A lot of times this idea of exposure was the baby would either just die from the elements or the baby would die from just some scavenger animal that would come and finally eat the child. Some of the Roman historians would describe that in the nights of the cities of Rome, what you could hear all throughout the city were babies crying, not because mothers can't put them to go to sleep, but because exposure was something that was happening at a rapid pace. This is how children were looked at in the ancient world. And Jesus says that the mysteries of the kingdom have not been revealed to the wise and the learned, but they have been revealed to the little children. Do you want to know that one of the Christians' number one evangelistic efforts in the ancient world was going around and picking up all the children that have been left to exposure and raising them up as their own? If you want to expand, love the orphans and the widows. You see, that starts to make a little bit of a difference when you hear that now, doesn't it? The orphans and the widows, two people that were considered by all society as parasites. Orphans could do nothing to provide for anybody. That's why, orphans, but widows also, that's why they'd end up having to go to either begging or prostitution because they weren't allowed to be making money themselves. Very rarely can a woman be successful like Lydia in the ancient world. Very rarely. Yes, Father, verse 26, for this was your good pleasure. Uh, All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Do you see that? He's describing the intimacy with which Jesus has the opportunity to reveal God, that reveal the God that has revealed himself even to little children. Whenever you have little children someday, you will understand kind of these passages better. There is so much of me that I wish that I could think even today the way before I have gone through all the education that I've gone through. Not that education is bad, but man, there's something that my children just get that I have lost, and I don't know how I've lost it. That they just get it. That whenever they're afraid, all they want to do, especially at night, is to jump into bed with mom and dad. They get it. That my son will ask some of the most intuitive questions. And whenever I look at him and I say, listen, I really don't know how to answer that. He's just like, that's okay, Dad, and moves on. There's just something that kids get that we've lost, or I've lost. Some of you maybe haven't, and I appreciate that. I even said this to Josh yesterday. There is something that I find deeply beautiful about the story of the rabbi whenever he is asked, why do you keep the dietary laws? And he says, because I don't know what they mean. Something about that intrigues me. Because I'm going, I want to be able to say that. Because my natural reaction is to say, yeah, we got to dissect these dietary laws and figure them all out. And what's the purpose? How do they fit in the grand scheme of the way in which I can envision everything? And there's something beautiful about just saying, oh, I have no idea why. It just is what it is. And I do think that verse 26, that this was God's good pleasure to reveal that. Verse 28, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. What is Jesus describing here, I think, is quite fascinating. Warren Carter brings this up. And when you look at the primary sources, the way in which yoke is used in the ancient world, you kind of get the understanding of what Jesus is talking about here. Because in Josephus' Jewish Wars, book 5, 365, book 7, 87, the yoke of Rome is used to describe the empire's political program. In Sibylline Oracles 3, 448, Sibylline Oracles 3, 537, and Sibylline Oracles 8, 126 through 127, this is a Jewish Christian document that started being written 200 BC and that was finished probably around 200 AD in that area. It describes Rome's control of the region of Rhodes as a terrible yoke. It describes Rome's yoke of slavery will come upon all of Greece. And I love this kind of prophetic proclamation against Rome whenever it says, no longer will Syrian, Greek, or foreigner, or any other nation place their neck under your yoke of slavery. What is it describing? What is yoke being used for? Yeah, the political system of Rome. Their political program, which becomes something that people have to bear and pull around like slaves. Now, here is the reality. All kingdoms are asking you to submit yourselves to them, a way in which a slave submits itself to a master. Every kingdom. The question is, what yoke are they giving you to carry? What is the political system that you're supposed to adhere to? And in Jesus' mind, what he is offering is, well, some people will call it embarrassing. Some people will call it childish. But Jesus says there is something that is beautiful and freeing about my system that says, if you submit yourself to something that is bigger than you, to provide for you your food, your clothes, your water, even vengeance, there's freedom in this like you've never experienced before. You're always a slave to something. True freedom never exists. We can pretend like it does. But even that, we're even slaves to the mirage of freedom. But in Jesus, there is freedom. Whenever you submit to something that's bigger than yourself, the question is, what is bigger than yourself that you're going to submit to? We try to pull it ourselves. Where are we at right now? 3 minutes. Let's move into chapter 12. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. Your initial reaction is, my word, the disciples are thieves. They're walking through grain fields. We know they're not theirs. How do we know that it's not their grain field? What? Yeah, half of them are fishermen. What else? Yeah, they've given up everything. Peter will remind us that in just a couple of chapters. Lord, we've given up absolutely everything to follow you. And Jesus says, yeah, I know, job well done. They weren't, yeah, we know these aren't their. So are they stealing? The answer is no. Deuteronomy chapter 23, 25 says, if you enter your neighbor's grain field, you may pick kernels with your hands, but you must not put a sickle to his standing grain. What is it saying? It is not your grain to harvest, but it is your neighbor's grain field, and you are allowed to pick the grains of head and to eat them. As a matter of fact, in Deuteronomy 24, 19 through 22, there are actual provisions that tell the people that are harvesting not to harvest the edges of their fields, so that, and it lists four different groups of people that can actually tap into this unharvested fruit, so that the poor, the alien, the stranger, the somebody that does not belong to your society, your community at all, the orphan and the widow can be provided with some food. So, were the disciples stealing? Absolutely not. And that's not even the accusation that the Pharisees bring against them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath. The issue here is Sabbath law, not whether or not they are stealing. And the Jews considered the Sabbath law something to be absolutely adhered to, not to mention the fact it was the fourth commandment out of the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, but also because the Jews believed that the reason why they went into exile, and this is true, was because of their rebelliousness against God's political system, against God's commands. That's why they were in exile. And so it was believed that if they were able to keep themselves absolutely pure in every aspect, that God would bring them out of exile. And that's the reason why the Pharisees came up with 39 categories. 39 categories that would be navigating what was lawful on the day of the Sabbath. These categories include, and this comes from Mishnah Shabbat number 7. These categories include kindling a fire, you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to extinguish your fire. So if your house goes up in flames, that's too bad on the Sabbath, according to the Pharisees. Erasing two or more letters was unlawful on the Sabbath. Sewing stitches, because stitches are much harder than just sewing in general, apparently. Separating two threads was unlawful on the Sabbath. Too vigorous. Why are they being this way? Is it because they're just pedantic? Partly. But primarily it's because they believe that ritual purity was what would bring back the exiles into their land. What would bring back. So if the Messiah's disciples, in plain view of the Messiah himself, were doing things that were impure, what does that say about the Messiah and his disciples? Yes, that's exactly right, Nathan. It's not the Messiah and the disciples. They're not doing what is right. And if they are impure, they're just like the Hasmoneans. If they are impure, they're going to be leading us back into an exile that may be even worse than the one we're experiencing right now. Their heart is in the right place, but they simply don't have ears to hear. And we'll talk about that in 2 days, because tomorrow's your test. Love you guys. If you have any questions about your inductive study, get them out of your system today. All right?